I write my books sometimes as these kind of wishes, not so much that I'm creating like a fantasy world of, you know, this world is like, it's all perfect by the end. I really allow for the fact that it's kind of not perfect, but that the characters are holding on to that hope and sort of the love they feel for each other.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Welcome to Sylvia and Me. I'm so excited to be here and talk with you today. I'm Veera Hiranandani. I write books for young people, mostly middle grade. I write a lot of historical fiction based on some of my own family history and some of my own experiences. And my most recent book is called A Meal in the After, which is a continuation of the story I began in my previous book, The Night Diary.
Veera, thank you so much for being here. And as you said, you thought we were in the conversation already, and we are. So we're starting this one off with the beginnings of a conversation. I just want to go into a little bit more of what you've done, because what you've done is award-winning, and should be mentioned. So you're the award-winning author of several books. As you said, A Meal and the After is your latest one. And that is basically a follow-up, not basically, but it is a follow-up to your previous Newbery Honor-winning The Night Diary, which received the 2019 Walter Dean Myers Honor Award, the 2018 Malka Penn Award for Human Rights in Children's Literature, and several other honors and state reading list awards. Your other middle grade historical novel, How to Find What You're Not Looking For, I love the title, received the 2022 Sidney Taylor Book Award, the 2022 Jane Addams Book Award, and the New York Historical Society Children's Book Prize, among others. And you've also written other books. The main thing is what you were saying just a few minutes ago about the fact that your books are, they're called middle grade, so they start at the age of 9. And so, you know, according to whoever puts out the rules and regs, it's from 9 to 12, but it's really from 9 to 99, because adults really need to read these books. Yeah. In order to understand so much. And as you said, as adults, we make the situations that we expect children to then deal with.
Absolutely.
You mentioned historical fiction, and your family is, your mother is Jewish American, your father is from a Hindu family in India, and you write about the partition when India and Pakistan were split, and the split between the Hindus and the Muslims, who were basically really living together without a lot of conflict until they were split, and then people had to pick sides almost.
Right.
You write this book, A Meal in the After, not through the eyes of the young boy, Emil, but almost through his drawings. Hmm. He has a twin sister who expresses herself through writing. Mm-hmm. And he expresses himself through drawings. They are now living in Bombay. Mm-hmm. And they are trying to, they've survived the violence that had gone on in order for them to be able to get to Bombay. Mm-hmm. And yet now they're struggling to survive the aftermath. And one of the things is that that you mentioned is you wrote the book during the second and third year of the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. You've said that one of the reasons, one of the questions in writing the book is, how do we heal after a traumatic experience as individuals and as a society? So can you tell us a little bit more about Emil and what this 12-year-old boy is going through and trying to figure out?
Sure. So, you know, The Night Diary, which is the book that came before, was very much focused on the immediate crisis of this family having to leave their homes in what is now Pakistan and crossing over the new border of India. And they end up going to Jodhpur, and it's seen through Nisha, whose twin brother is Emil, their brother and sister. But it's seen through her fictional diary perspective as she writes about that immediate crisis. But one thing that I was thinking about is, you know, after the pandemic and kind of what our family went through, and then watching what so many other people went through, and there were just so many levels of suffering and struggle, and everybody was affected by it, and everybody was somewhat traumatized by it. You know, I was thinking about the fallout. What are we left with? How do we rebuild our lives after? And often in historical fiction or any book that sort of takes place focusing on a big event, a big world event, a lot of historical novels are focused on war or some kind of crisis. You know, we tend to just focus on, are these characters going to survive? And hopefully they do. And then the story ends. So I wanted to write a story about what happens after. And I also wanted to explore more of Emil's perspective. It is in third person, so it's not a first person perspective, but it's in his head. And as you said, it's told through how he expresses himself in these drawings. So I wanted to show, you know, how they are kind of dealing with their post-traumatic stress, how at times he just wants to be a kid and he wants to focus on simple things like hanging out with his friends and getting a bike to ride around, and how he can get more sweets, and when can he go to the cinema. Yeah, and then the backdrop of being aware, because he's 12, of all of the things that have happened and kind of that he's lucky to be alive. And so what does a 12-year-old feel when they're carrying all of that in their head? And then, you know, how does this family kind of put their lives back together knowing all of that? So that's what I tried to do.
And you've done it brilliantly, as far as I'm concerned. This little boy, Emil, he's different from his twin sister. His twin sister is very shy, mm-hmm. and she focuses and she writes. She's the one who actually gives her brother Emil the direction of, or the thought, the idea of drawing. Mm-hmm. And they lost their mother. She died during childbirth, or after she gave birth to them. And so he's kind of writing to his mother and asking her questions, because you can see that he's only 12. Although he's gone through all of this trauma, which he hasn't totally, he hasn't really put it all into place as most adults can't. Excuse me. He's questioning where he goes, where does he fit in? Mm-hmm. And as he's looking for a friend in his new life,
right,
how does he go about? Because there's so much bias. There's so much. He comes from, his mother was Muslim. His right. father is Hindu.
Yeah.
How, and they have to almost put aside the fact and put away and hide the fact that their mother was Muslim.
Right.
So how do you? You've created this character, this little boy, and his sister. How could you go about doing it with such compassion and almost awareness of what they've gone through and what is happening now?
Yeah, I think it's just sort of I tend to approach my characters by putting myself into those characters. I don't necessarily write watching my characters. I definitely really try to become the main character. So it's almost like acting on the page, because I was interested in theater for a while, but I wasn't very good at it. I love stories and I love telling stories. But I was better expressing myself through writing than on the stage. But it's very much getting into that character's head and becoming that character and doing the research, certainly, of hearing stories from my father and my father's side of the family and family friends, and then extending my research out to, you know, collected oral histories about the partition and reading more academic books and just trying to get as many different perspectives as I could about what happened. So perspectives from Hindu families, Muslim families, another religious group, Sikh families were very involved, and just how they felt having to leave their homes. And a lot of these memories are from their childhood memories because, you know, my father, he just turned 86, but he was 9 when the partition happened. So his memories are very childlike and innocent. And he was just kind of following the adults and doing what they told him to do, trusting them to keep him safe. And they did, luckily. And, you know, my father's family was a Hindu family. So I wanted to tell this story based on the family history that I was most familiar with, a Hindu family traveling in the direction a Hindu family would travel. But I also had a lot of questions about how these borders and these lines and this division created so much tension and violence particularly between the Hindu and Muslim community. So I wanted to create a family where the kids felt like they had a connection and their identity was connected to both of these groups, and that their, you know, country is being split apart along religious lines. So what does that mean for their identity? And just really opening up that question of how we live under these labels, whatever they are, just because, you know, they didn't have any control. Emil doesn't have any control over the fact that his mother is Muslim and his father is Hindu, and this is what's happening, and this is where they're going. So how do you process that as a young person? And often those questions are really honest. Like, why do these labels matter so much? Why did we live in a community where all of the religious groups really seemed, in, from his perspective, to get along? And even in the area that he comes from in Sindh, what is now Pakistan, my father says, in the reading that I've done, there was a lot of almost like pluralism and almost like a kind of an overlapping sometimes between religious communities and traditions and practices. And then it just really changed overnight. And so he's asking the question that I still, you know, want to fully understand of, why do we do this to each other as human beings? How did it happen so quickly? You know, I think it's very much about kind of just these borders that we create. And once you're on one side or another, that's part of what creates the tension. So I really wanted to try to examine that.
Well, you definitely did. And you brought in a third character. He finally makes a friend. And the friend tells him eventually that he's been living at a refugee camp.
Right.
And his real name is Basim. He's a Muslim.
I don't want to give too many spoilers, though.
No. Okay. I'm sorry. But the bottom line is the relationship. It's the innocence of children. It's trying to figure out what's going on. It's trying to not only figure out, but why? Why can't they help everyone? Why, before all this happened, they were playing with each other. There wasn't a question that somebody was a different religion, came from a different background. And again, why did this happen? And how do we even handle it? But I love, there's something that you wrote in the back of the book. We may not all be the same, but we are all connected by our humanity. When we harm each other, we harm ourselves. Conversely, when we support and help each other, we make our lives better. And that is so true. If more people understood that. You also talk a lot, and I'm bringing this up because when you put in on your full bio, you wrote about how food is a thing that helped you connect. Mm-hmm. As you know, I said you came from your mother was Jewish American, your father came from a Hindu family, and food you have in the book. I'm not giving that away. You have a lot of food, but you grew up with different matzo ball soup, samosas, right. And food does have a way of bringing people together. I mean, when you go out on a date, you usually eat when you have families together. So how does that play into being able to almost assimilate people from so many different backgrounds?
Yeah, food is so important to our culture. And you certainly, know that people know that. But when you really look at it, like for me growing up, I come from an interfaith family. And so sometimes I would feel a little different than the cousins on my Jewish side or the cousins on my Hindu side, because my cousins had two Jewish parents or two Hindu parents, and tended to be kind of a little more religious in that sense, or just practiced in a different way. I think my parents handled their interfaith household by being more secular. And so I didn't have a bat mitzvah. I didn't go to India every year like my Indian cousins did. We only went a few times. And so I tended to feel kind of separate, even in my own family, along with kind of separate out in my small town Connecticut world of like, oh, am I the only one that kind of has this combined identity? But I turned to food because I love food. I love cooking. I love tasting all kinds of things. And food culture on both sides of my family were where I knew the food. I was sort of literate in the food. And that was the place that I felt most connected and kind of most secure in my identity. And I carry that with me today. And that's part of the reason why I love writing about food, because it can tell you so much about the characters, not only just, what cultural background they're from, but like how they relate to food, what they like to eat. You get to include all these wonderful sensory details. I love making my readers hungry. So I think food is really important to characterization. And I always feel disappointed when I'm reading a book and, let's say the characters have lunch and the writer doesn't say, the author doesn't say what they're having for lunch. I always want to know what people are having at every meal. Like, please describe it to me, because I can really picture the world of the character that way. So that's a huge reason why I write about food, and literally in all my books.
You use it to show how someone's feeling.
Yeah.
If someone's feeling down or they're sick, are they going to eat? What are they eating? What are they making? And you use that throughout the book. Mm-hmm. As Emil uses his drawings and his sister uses her words, other characters use food.
Absolutely. Everybody has what they like and what they don't like. And one of their family members, really, even though he's not blood related to them, is Kazi, their cook, who ends up coming with them in the Night Diary. I won't sort of tell exactly how, because I don't want to spoil anything in the Night Diary, but he ends up living with them and becoming more a part of their family, just aside from just being their family cook. And he really takes care of Emil and Nisha through food. That's a way that he connects with them and shows his love for them. And that's another thing, thinking about just food culture in India and Pakistan. There are so many commonalities between the food culture, and so I think about that link all the time, even though we think about it's two separate countries, but they were one country, and there were so many blending of food cultures in India, even though they're different, different foods in the north and the south and all of that, it's still very similar in both countries.
So you write for the middle grade, as we said, 9 to 12. Who do you think, I'll ask it in a different way. Why do you think the older generation, adults, should be reading these books?
Hmm. Well, I think it's great for, I don't want to tell anybody, you know, sort of what they should read, but I think it's really great.
What they're trying to tell us what we shouldn't read.
My books. Well, I kind of feel that way. You should. questions in these books. But I think that one thing that's been really beautiful for me to hear about with particularly The Night Diary and A Meal in the After is that generations, sort of three generations, will read these books. If they, let's say the grandparent has a connection to the partition or is a partition survivor, and then their child is my age, and then that parent's children, all kind of reading the book together in a way to open up what is a really difficult topic sometimes to talk about, depending especially on what the grandparent went through during the partition and was, you know, how traumatic was it? I mean, my family in particular, they did make it safely. They didn't encounter direct violence, but I have extended relatives who did encounter direct violence and go through much harder things. So it's a lot harder to talk about and kind of go back to those really traumatic events. But I've had generations read my book, and sometimes I get emails from, you know, the parent or something of how meaningful it was to be able to kind of have the book as this vehicle to talk about this history in maybe a softer way, because I am writing these book primarily for young readers. So I want to include the truth of what happened and kind of the emotional truth and a lot of the sort of bigger details of the history. But at the same time, I'm a parent. I am kind of protecting the reader in that way. I'm not going to show every sort of violent moment or graphic moment. I read, you know, in my research, I read about really unimaginable things, but that wasn't what I was trying to do in this book. I wanted to show a certain kind of truth, but also make it readable for a young reader and not particularly traumatic. But I think for adults too, it's kind of easier to hear history that way and understand that sort of younger perspective. I just think it can kind of focus the questions to be sort of more, not that the word's not pure, but just kind of innocent. And maybe what we're all kind of wondering about, maybe as an adult, we're afraid to ask because it might not sound as, you know, knowledgeable about the events. If you kind of ask these questions like, well, why would the two religious groups living together, why would they suddenly, you know, want to hurt each other? Why would people want to hurt each other? A lot of adults think those questions too, but they don't feel comfortable maybe asking it like that. But I think we all have that child in us that's like, why would we do this to each other? I certainly still do. So,
well, you're giving adults a pathway. You're giving them like, I forget what we used to call it, but a helper, a reading guide as to how to talk to their children about something that they might have heard about, but really don't know how to ask and have questions. And, you know, a lot of times as adults, we try to protect our children when we're doing more harm by not giving them the information, the facts, and doing it in a way that won't scare them, but teach them.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. You're talking about a time in history that was horrific and happened back in 1947, 1948. Go to where we are now in the present day, mm-hmm. and it's not two different countries against each other, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, it's just, we have so many things that we are reliving, and we don't always have the tools or the ability to talk to our children, talk to youth about what is going on and what went on. And history is very important for our children to learn and know about. And we can't be afraid to talk to them about it, but it really has to be done in the right way. Some people might just tell me there's no right and wrong, but in a way that you present it, in a soft way without hiding what went on. without hiding feelings, without trying to protect everyone's feelings. I think that's so important.
Thank you. And I was really trying to balance that, you know, to not sugarcoat what happened, because I know when I was a kid, sort of hearing about the partition, I felt like I wasn't hearing the full story. And I do remember going to see the movie Gandhi that came out when I was 11. And I was kind of shocked, because even though it's a big Hollywood depiction of Gandhi's life, you know, it did show a lot of the violence that happened during the partition, a lot of the issues. And I was like, this is what you meant? This is the partition? This is part of my family history? It was like shocking. And I do hope my books can kind of allow readers, both younger and older, to wrap their heads around what happened, wrap their heads around some of the harder questions, but still, you know, again, not be completely traumatized by the experience of reading the book. And then it gives space to think about what happened, and then make parallels into, you know, our current world and how, you know, the ways that we can hurt each other now.
Well, is it giving away anything if I say what Emil stands for, why his mother named him Emil?
No, you can say that. Yeah.
Hope. Right. And I think that's what your book gives, is hope. Through all of the trauma, through the survivorship, and through living and trying to figure out, through the whole book, there's hope. And I think that's something that we need to always hold on to.
We have to, you know, that sometimes it feels like it's all we have. And so I write my books sometimes as these kind of wishes, not so much that I'm creating like a fantasy world of, you know, this world is like, it's all perfect by the end. I really allow for the fact that it's kind of not perfect, but that the characters are holding on to that hope and sort of the love they feel for each other. And that is kind of sometimes all we can do. At one point, one of the characters, Kazi, says, you know, imagine if, and one person who isn't suffering as much helps one person who's suffering more. Imagine if we all did that. And I think about that a lot, which is why I had him say it, because I'm the author. So, yeah.
Mira, where can people find out more about you?
On my website, www.virahiranandani.com, or on Instagram at Vera Writes, or X, formerly Twitter, at Vera Hira. And I post, you know, different things that I'm doing and events and news and all of that.
Well, Vera, Emil and the After, let's say. Beautiful. And I thank you so much for taking the time to be with me here today. And the book is very hopeful.
Hopeful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.